This is Thrive Perspectives, an ever-growing discussion about the issues and ideas that shape our lives with your guide, Dr. Matthew Jacoby.
Welcome, listeners, to this episode of Thrive Perspectives. I'm Stu, your host for the Thrive Today podcasts. What makes us click? Why do we find ourselves drawn to social media or platform posts that make our blood boil? They call it rage bait. Could it be that every time we take the bait, we're being trained to love division more than reconciliation? What if the Spirit is calling us not to amplify rage, but to embody peace? Let's join Matt and Connell as we ask the question, could it be that rage bait isn't just about algorithms and attention, but about temptation, about the subtle lure to trade patience for reaction, pride for humility, love for division? Good morning, Matt. Good morning, Connell.
Morning.
Here we go.
Yeah, good to be back in the studio. Thrive Perspectives. We've already been talking for the last hour and a half. Not quite that long about our topic today. As you will know, listeners, we're going to be talking about a thing that's been labeled rage bait today. And I think it'd be good, maybe if you could define rage bait first.
Well, just to let listeners in, it's been tough to decide actually how we do this because we're aware of sensitivities out there. And you know, one of the questions we ask is, do we use specific examples? And we're probably not. And don't get frustrated by that because we want to discipline ourselves to take just a slightly bigger view. We just want to draw out of the issues themselves. And there are a number of different kinds of issues out there that people get really heated about. And these are the issues that, you know, you're prepared to, I mean, in some scenarios, like I know of families that have had bust ups over issues that are happening in other countries.
Yeah.
And families have been reduced to tears and angry and yelling at each other and because of opinions that people hold about things thousands of kilometers away. You know, this is, I think, a really important issue. We particularly want to address how this is happening because this is a particular cultural phenomenon that's characteristic of our time. So there's something driving this. This is not a conspiracy because it's quite well known what's driving this. You know, we're not going to get into any other conspiracy theories under the level. We're just going to go with just the fact about media algorithms and so forth.
And that the content's engineered for a reaction.
Yeah,
they
want to
provoke a reaction.
Yeah, that's right. But let me start with a personal reflection on why I brought this subject up because in moments of like sitting down and moments of boredom or whatever, I open up Facebook and watch real, you know, oh, that's interesting, watch a real, or YouTube or something like that. Mm-hmm. And you watch a real, and they're normally about a couple of minutes or, you know, sometimes a bit longer. And it'll be on an issue that I happen to be on the side of the person, like somewhat on the side of the person that, or sympathetic to the view that's being espoused on these little, you know, it might be an expert somewhere in some forum, you know, it'll be a clip of them sort of vociferating about this other group of people, you know, whatever. Yep. And, you know, I'm watching this. This is my personal reflection. Yes, right. I'm watching this and it's making me angry, you know. That's true. That's a great point, right? And of course, because I've watched it, it feeds me more. And in a moment, you can explain how that works, Connell. But it just, and it feeds me more.
Feeds you more of the same position.
The same position, right.
Which reinforces that you're right, that's true. Yeah.
And I was just analyzing my reaction to it because, you know, what it was feeding me was people who are good at doing this stuff, you know. I mean, they're very articulate. And I'm going to assume actually that it is the fact. So I'm not, we're not going to deal with disinformation. Now that these things are the facts, of course, is another topic and we can't necessarily take that for granted. But let's just assume for the sake of argument.
Yes,
right?
Let's just assume
that it is it is the facts. And in this particular issue, I felt fairly confident because I haven't just watched. I've actually done a lot of in-depth reading on you know, some of these topics. And so, you know, felt, well, I mean,
This is not wrong.
They've got a point here. But it had this effect that the world started, and this is speaking emotionally. It's like I found this contradiction between what in my head, you know, as I hope fairly sound critical thinker, I realized in my head was wrong. But in my heart, the world was polarizing into good guys and bad guys.
Yeah.
And this person was arguing for the good guys against the bad guys. Mm. And I found myself getting really angry at the bad guys, not caring what happened to those bad guys necessarily. And it sort of resolved that polarizing of the world, because there's something in me that wants things to be simple. There's something in me that wants things to be black and white. The tension of complexity is hard to hold on to.
Well, we can just park it, move on then. We've made up our mind.
And this is the thing, like I know all this in my head, but as I'm bombarding myself, and there's probably the problem, and since recognizing my fairly dysfunctional reaction, I would say, I've actually measured how much of this stuff, like I can, there's only so much of this stuff I can actually take. Let's never assume that we can take loads of temptation. Now, I mean, you think, hang on, but if it's just the facts, how is it a bad thing? No, but it can still draw you into dysfunctional forms of response. Mm. And actually, I was finding it was drawing me to become not only angry with the other side, the so-called bad guys. Now, should go without saying that the world doesn't consist of good guys and bad guys. Yes, of course, some people may be more culpable than other people and so forth. Mm-hmm. We admit to that. But it was drawing me into this and also making me angry even with the people that side or that are sympathetic mm-hmm. towards the bad guys, right? And so that even can affect relationships here actually in my life. It can affect the way that I relate to other people. And I can therefore understand why these bust-ups actually happen. And the other effect is that what tends to happen when we polarize the world into these black and white, you know, these are the good guys and these are the bad guys. And if you hold this opinion, well, you're actually a bad guy too. And generally, to simplify this, because again, simplification, you know, is one of the things that we tend towards here. We tend to have these big epitaphs that we throw out there. Oh, you're just a, you know, I mean, I get this in discussion. This is one that we have talked about that I'm happy to, you know, like even Christian positions on sexual ethics, for example. We know as Christians that we have these broad sort of caricatured epitaphs thrown. Oh, you're homophobic. No, I'm not. But it's like that ends the debate.
Yeah.
Right? That puts you into the camp with the most bigoted, combative, insensitive version of whatever. It's like a caricature of what a Christian is. You know, as soon as someone hears me suggesting that I might not be same-sex affirming, for example, affirming, you're immediately cast into a sort of caricature. And it's a way of almost ending the conversation. I'm not going to listen to you because you are this sort of monstrous thing. And people end debates that way.
Yeah.
Like, oh, no, I'm not going to listen to you because you're homophobic.
But this is the problem. Like that's a good example, I think, of how we like to break issues down. And I think we see that pattern planted on whether it's politics and conflicts in the world and, you know, what different people are doing in the world that we get angry about. I think that we want to simplify everything down, as you said, like polarizing it. So it's black or white. And it's that simplification that we're looking for, because in all of these things, I don't think there's many issues in the world where there isn't a lot of nuance that sits behind every single issue. That is why makes these things so difficult to actually solve. But I don't think we have an appetite for nuance.
No.
That's the problem. So we only want...
No, we want it to be simple.
Give me the simple explanation. And therefore, the minimum set of facts that I need to form an opinion so that I know which bit of ground I'm going to stand on. And anything beyond that, I don't have the time or attention or interest in. I feel like I do have that, but I still feel the temptation and I still fall into the trap of trying to look for the simple understanding, the simple explanation.
Essentially condense it down to a simple form.
Yeah.
Just before we get too far into this, I think it'd be great to actually get Connell just to explain a little bit very briefly about, you know, how this works in, you know, social media and YouTube and all that kind of stuff, in terms of the way that algorithms kind of work to, you know, where you explain it.
Well, of course, all of these platforms are all about making money, and the money largely comes in the form of advertising revenue. So in terms of these platforms, you could be an advertiser and trying to sell your products and reaching huge audiences, and it's a very effective advertising mechanism. Obviously, for the platform, they get advertising revenue from people paying for the advertising. But the only thing that's ever going to bring people to the platform is the people putting the content up, which is everybody else in the world that they're trying to produce the content for. So if you take an example like YouTube, when you watch YouTube, there's ads that are played through through the video. And so the more eyeballs on that ad, the more money that YouTube makes. But it's not just about YouTube, it's also the content creator makes money as well. And so the more views that they get turns into more people that subscribe and listen to more of their content. But the more views that they get, the more revenue they themselves get. So a lot of these people who've got substantial followings, this is their job, to create this content and to get as many eyeballs on that content as possible, because that is their full-time job and their income stream. Now, not everybody's into it in that scale, but there is quite a substantial amount of money out there if you can create content to get people to,
and that
to look at
that it. Doesn't mean that people are creating content just to make money. Like, you can create content for the right reasons.
You can.
I'm more interested, Conal, in like actual YouTube itself and how it instrumentalizes all of this content.
So then to get more eyeballs on it, YouTube needs to figure out.
For example, we're using YouTube.
Yeah, we're not having a crack at YouTube here. YouTube is a wonderful
platform. Facebook YouTube. Or TikTok or all of these platforms.
They're all the same.
Yep. So in order to get more eyeballs on it, YouTube needs to figure out what do you want to look at, to make sure that with your little limited attention span, they're going to get the most likely things into your view that you're going to watch.
So that you keep watching it for as long as possible.
Keep consuming. So if you were to go onto my YouTube, actually, it's probably not a very good example.
No, I don't think that's a good idea.
Most people, when you go into the YouTube, you can actually build up a pretty good picture of what they're like, what their views are and what they're interested in. Because as soon as you click on something, YouTube, sort of interested in that. I'm going to get a whole lot more of this content and bring it your way to get you looking at it. And you can tell from the titles and so on YouTube clips that it's like the five things that you didn't know about, and you watch it and there was nothing on there that I didn't know about. Everything's written in a way to naturally stimulate your curiosity to want to watch that video. So then with YouTube, you look at it and it's all full of all the propaganda and political biases and everything that kind of align with what I think. And it's very, very clever at doing that, because I find that I'll click on something that's on the other side of view and YouTube says, you're interested. And all of a sudden my YouTube's full of all the stuff that I'm not actually that interested in. Yeah. And I've got to flush it all out and start all over again.
Yeah, yeah.
So I've got to be very careful about what I click on, because YouTube then gets it wrong, especially for me, because I'm hopping around and looking at different
things. Or when you jump on, because sometimes I'll just jump on and I'll search for stuff, because I've been searching for theology stuff lately, because I'm putting together some stuff for church. And Jeremiah, I accidentally did all of this searching on his account, on my son's account. And he said, "Dad, what have you done? My algorithm's messed up. There's all of this stuff on
That's a great point, because I was going to say, let's not get into this, but let's just assume there isn't a political agenda for YouTube or Facebook or TikTok. Let's just assume that, because the same thing will happen if I searched up getting rid of middle-aged man belly or something suddenly everything appears in my feed and that's what it is. And I don't know if this is true, and a little bit of an aside, but sometimes I'll just be talking about something, not even looking it up on my phone, and the next time I get all these ads, all these posts. Are they listening to me?
And they're all interconnected.
Yeah.
They all share data. So what you're doing in one affects all the others. And if you're logged into your Google account, they're watching your search, which then affects everything down through YouTube, and they would likely pass that information onto Facebook, and you'll get that constant
bombardment
of reinforcing what it is that you want to look at or is most likely going to fit your point of view.
Yeah.
Okay, so the thing that we're concerned about here is one of the things that they seem to have worked out that gets people hooked is things that make you angry. And this is where we're getting onto rage bait, right? Now, this is very interesting. You know, why do we as humans, and this is where I want to get under this a little bit, that's a really interesting feature of our humanity, that one of the most powerful ways to get you back is to lure you with things that are going to make you angry.
Can I suggest?
Yeah.
That's a lot to do with human psychology. I think we need more and more dopamine hits, and that feeds that whole thing.
Yeah.
The tribal identity thing, which we talked about before, where we want to kind of be part of something bigger than just us. You know, we want to find people that agree with us, you know.
Because I think this rage bait thing is another thing on top of the fact of the dopamine hit.
Yep.
So I will easily get sucked into watching reels where I watch a reel and then the next reel's kind of already poking its head up and I can see it and go, oh, I wonder what that one is. And I'll click on that. I'll go, oh, I'll watch one more. And before I know it, I've watched a whole hour of absolute drivel. I've got nothing from it whatsoever. And it's just like kind of like, what? Man, I've just wasted
I think we've all been
hour.
There.
Yeah.
Now, I think I've learned to tame the rage side of it. Now, the rage side of it goes to another level because the rage side of it achieves two things, are just getting the dopamine of being entertained. You know, that's just a time-wasting thing.
The thing that annoys me, Connell, a little bit that causes me rage. The thing that I think... Let's say that I think is a big problem about that is that people justify it by calling it research. Yeah. I have a very big problem with calling that. Oh, no, I've been researching.
Good point.
No, I mean, one of the things with research is that involves active engagement with a source of information. So you have to go slow enough and it has to be long form enough to allow you the time to think creatively and certainly think critically. But when you're being bombarded by short form, I mean, I would regard a 20-minute video as short form, let alone 30 seconds, 2 minutes.
Yep.
This is why, for example, like reading a book where an argument is put thoroughly and it gives you time to think critically and engage with that. And but of course, I mean, one of the problems is people don't read books anymore. And I actually, one of the reasons why people don't read books is that our attention span has been dramatically affected actually by all of this short form media. So we have become more impatient. So think about this, we've become more impatient. And so we want these quick answers when actually, you know, patience is one of the virtues that we want to uphold, right? And anger is associated with impatience as well. We've got to remember the connection between those two things. And so I think there is a problem with calling that fairly impatient process of information intake, calling that
And that's
research.
Also because I want to get the information as quick as I possibly can and so that I can distill it all down in something that makes sense to me and I can go, all right, I've now formed my view on that. And I'm not really interested in going then any deeper than that because I just want to quickly get to know what side of the fence that I'm on. I might think I've done the research, but I haven't really.
Which essentially means you want to find out in your mind who's the good guys in this and who's the bad guys in this.
Yeah, and I just want to quickly form an opinion on it. And it gives you the impression that you've done that adequately.
Let me ask you this. Why do you want that? This is the thing that I'm interested in here. Because I know the feeling of that. I just want to quickly form an opinion. I want to be able to say, no, I know what's going on here. This is this, bang. Why do we want that?
Maybe because I'm being confronted with it and I feel like maybe I'm reacting to something and maybe it makes me angry and maybe I want to become a bit more confident of what side I, what tribe do I want to belong to. I think maybe there is that tribal element there where I'm not even so much interested in the cause or the problem, but I'm more interested in trying to figure out what tribe do I need to belong to and what, how do I win against the other tribe. So then the mission becomes more about not solving the problem or being working for good in that cause, but it becomes more about how do I win the argument or how do I feel equipped or to be the better person in this because I've got the truer facts. So it actually becomes more about...
Even tribalism... See, the thing is, even underneath tribalism, to me, I guess what I want to get back to is almost like the fundamental things that we know theologically about, and this is not just theory, like this is actually something that we experience all the time, about human nature and what we know about what makes us vulnerable to certain forms of dysfunctional behavior. This is what I mean. So the core, and this has been well discussed in this podcast, you know, perhaps the core element of our human condition is what I've described as a kind of God complex.
The tree like of the knowledge.
The tree of the knowledge of good and evil, right? Which is the temptation to know in such a way that makes you the judge.
Yes.
No, I know what's going on here. This is right. This is wrong. And we've got to, you know, recognize that that's not just theory. That's just not just a bit of abstract theology. We live with this. Yeah. We live with this human condition, which means it makes us really vulnerable, right? It's like in the same way, when you open up that app, and I'm picking up my phone just naturally, right? Because it's a matter of habit. And you're looking through those reels. You're not neutral, no. Right? You have a condition, and it's something like, imagine someone who's been chronic alcoholic, thinking that such a person can be neutral walking into a pub. Like, let's say, Connell, you're a recovered alcoholic. For me to say, oh, let's go meet down the pub and you can just have a lemonade, or like, you'd be a fool if you thought that you could confront yourself with that in a completely neutral way. I mean, that example is imperfect because maybe some, but the fact is we've got a problem way, way deep in that. Mm. We've got something like the deepest form of addiction, and it's addiction to a kind of God complex, right? And
so is it like an addiction to feeling like we have knowledge?
Well, yeah, a sort of, but not just knowledge that allows us to judge in a very polarized way.
That articulates better. We're always kind of like thinking about the tribal. It's a better way of articulating it.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think within me, honestly, what do I want? I do want knowledge, and I want to feel like I've got the right knowledge. And sometimes that leads into...
It's never neutral. That's the thing. The knowledge is...
I know, but what's driving me to want to consume that is, to me, wanting to be the judge in a sense. Not even like, well, not the judge, but maybe having the superiority in the knowledge.
Yeah, and I'm talking particularly about what makes us vulnerable to this kind of thing. Yeah. So we're talking about rage bait, right? Okay, you know, I might have an algorithm that brings up, you know, videos of cute puppy dogs or something. Let's just put that, you know, we're talking about...
That's how they're going to drive rage.
Yeah, we're talking about, you know, the stuff that is really, really divisive here. This is the problematic stuff. And my contention is that we need to be self-critical about our ability to actually take this stuff. I mean, as I've discovered this, I really haven't stopped actually exposing myself to this short form, well, rage bait, because I actually don't back myself to be, I mean, it does help thinking critically and being self-aware. So I can look at it and think, okay, this is polarizing the issue in my mind. It's making me care less about those other people that they're talking about. But still, I just don't need to be bombarded with this stuff. I'm not going to back my ability, you know, to walk into the pub and be confronted by that stuff that clearly my human nature is vulnerable
to. This stuff is also like, it kind of snowballs. So if you have a bias one way, you're more likely to click on something that kind of like affirms, supports what you're already kind of predisposed to. You're leaning a particular way on a particular issue. So you're more likely to find something that not just supports it, but arms you with even more knowledge to bolster that position. And then the algorithms will keep serving up more and more of it to you so that you consume even more of it. So you become even more cemented in that position. So it's designed to kind of like almost like trap you in a room where you only hear that.
Yeah. And the problem is that our impatience, because we have this condition, if you have an addiction, you want to get that thing as quickly as possible. There's no patience in that. So I'm likening our human. I'm taking very seriously the fact that the heart is deceitful above all things. Right? I'm taking the biblical doctrine of sin very seriously here. Okay, so we're recovered sinners. Let's call ourselves, you know, or recovering. Perhaps the participle is a better way to put that. So because we have that, there's a natural impatience to get to that. Yeah. You know, to get to the other side, which is where, you know, I mean, I think we're drawn to these short form sort of things that really, because it just gets us there. it's the quickest hit. It's a quick hit that gets us to our goal. And the other thing, this is also where those caricatured epitaphs that we use, the big things that we throw, fascist, you know, like, or whatever, like big term, you're a commie, you're a,
whatever.
You just put them all out there, you know, and that's also a sign of impatience, right? I'm not going to listen. I've stamped on your forehead effectively this judgment. Bang, you're this. Mm. So therefore, I've judged you. Once I've judged you, I can't hear you. There's no way there's no way I'm going to listen to you.
And you watch a lot of these debates between people with different positions, and you can see exactly that on all sides. The inability to hear each other is just shut down. And this is the problem.
Because we've already caricatured the other person.
Sometimes I get drawn into them between all sorts of different issues. But you always sort of like kind of think, but nobody's listening. Nobody is actually listening to each other here. Nobody seems to have any capacity to absorb what the other side's saying.
Yeah. I discovered that in myself some years ago when I was with a fellow Christian. We were debating a particular thing about biblical doctrine. We met every lunchtime once a week on a lunchtime to discuss this issue and present our different positions on it. And we both came to this realization, neither of us actually wants to find the truth. We just want to be right.
Mm. Yeah.
So we start from our position of right and we try to make our position of right be the truth. And that's not.
And I think recognizing that we're not starting from a neutral starting point, you know, to be able to recognize, you know what, I actually want to be right more than I want to know the truth.
Correct. Mm-hmm. The second thing is, you asked Connell before what you thought drove him to do this. I feel, for me, I've been thinking about this a bit as well as all of us about how this affects me. I think it's pride. I want to know what I know. I want to know what part I'm on, so that if anyone asks me, I can be really clear about what I think is right.
But I would say pride. I would say pride is the God complex.
Yes, but then the other side of that is fear. I think there's two things there: pride and fear. The fear of not knowing.
Yes.
In essence, you know, Satan was the first clickbait. Really, did God really say that?
Yeah.
You could be like this. So I think going back to there and understanding that's the condition we're in really is a strong thing. And of course, those two things are completely opposed to the fruit of the Spirit, which we talked about before as we see them in Galatians, pride and fear.
Mm. Yeah. So what would it look like? Let me ask this question to move us forward here. Mm. What would it look like to approach this in a way that's conducive with the fruit of the Spirit?
Mm.
Right. Mm. What would be a responsible, you know, way to approach this? Now, it's quite an old book now, but it got me started thinking. Well, there's actually a couple of books. One is a very famous, it's a secular publication called Amusing Ourselves to Death, written in the 1980s, right, by Neil Postman.
Amusing Ourselves to Death.
And it's still quoted all the time. I see it quoted all over the place because, you know, he essentially analyzes all media, even news media, is essentially a form of entertainment. He's wanting us to think critically about the information that we're bombarded with. Now, that's in the 80s, right? So the other one is a book called Reading the Times, subtitle, I think, Theological Reflections on the News.
I'll put it in the notes, Matt.
One of the points that he makes in that book is that there's only so much information that we can meaningfully interact with, like, you know, in terms of world history, this unusual access to a lot of information. And it's not really natural to know that much about everything that's happening in the world all at once, right?
Yeah.
And so we've got to be aware of that. It's actually, this is not a natural state of being, really, to know this much, right? To be bombarded.
I've often thought that because I feel like there's so much that I can know. That in itself is kind of addictive to me. It makes me go looking for it because I can learn about almost everything and I can do it quickly. I don't have to go and do a course I can consume like so much information across so many topics all over the world that when I go back 20 years ago, that all was still out there, but it wasn't accessible.
Encyclopedia
to
Britannica.
Me. So
yeah.
It's
and,
a
and
profound
even,
impact.
Yeah.
That
yeah.
So even, totally. Even what we get and even Neil Postman makes his point back in the 80s. And he says, you know, the news stories, they'll throw up some big new thing, a war that started in somewhere. But after a while, people get tired of hearing about the same, because wars go on for years, right? I mean, this is his argument is that it's basically all becomes entertainment, right? Because once we're likely to get bored of it, the news stops showing and goes to the next thing, right? Now, the war is still happening and terrible things are still happening.
Yeah.
But it moves on to the next thing because it's got to keep us, you know, got to keep us interested.
And I think the same thing speaks to what Conor was saying before about once you, in a sense, indicate to the platform your position, then it's no longer information that's informing you of the facts. It's now just entertaining you with what you want to hear in
yeah,
reality.
Well, and it's entertaining is perhaps a euphemism here because, like, and again, I would say if we bring up to the present with, you know, these algorithms, it's essentially drawing us or tempting us into, you know, a way of thinking, a disposition which we are dysfunctionally inclined towards, right?
Yeah.
This is, and so this is where the conversation around what are some Christian virtues here that we can uphold that will help us to navigate this. Now, one of the ones I want to start with is humility. And this is, I think, important because the only way you can get to making a judgment, I mean, that's already very problematic, right? But, you know, humility is the opposite to the pride that you talked about, Stu. So I'm gonna talk a lot about humility here. Of course, humility says, look, I'm not the judge. But we need to empower, humility needs to empower itself by recognizing we don't have the capacity. Like, not only is it not our prerogative to judge, but we don't even have the capacity, really, to judge. Because situations are complex. Even the sequence of facts will only have a certain number of the facts. Now, even if we have all the facts, there's still a decision that we've got to make as to how to piece together a story from those facts. So I want to make the distinction between the facts and the truth, okay? So the facts are bits of events, things that people have said and done, right? Mm-hmm. And we've pictured in a previous episode, pictured, you know, let's say you have a page and on that page you've got thousands and thousands of little dots and each of those dots stands for a fact. To create a story, what you do is that you draw connections between dots, you know, and you create a story, you piece together, selectively piece together facts to create a story or a nuance on the facts. Now, because of that, because facts always have to be interpreted in relation to each other. So, you know, a detective walks into a room and they see someone lying on the floor and a knife there. And there's a lot of different facts and they piece together a story from the facts. Now, that may or may not be the right story.
Yeah.
And the detective has to face the fact that life, human motivation, human behavior is very, very complex, right? Mm. So I can't jump to conclusions. You never jump to conclusions.
Which is often called circumstantial evidence. It's just the circumstances of what you find as facts.
Yeah. Now, why would we jump to a conclusion? The reason we would jump to conclusions is we're tempted in our impatience, right, to get to this place where we can just resolve it in our mind, make a judgment, bang, right? Bad guy, good guy.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we also know that the world isn't divided into bad guys and good guys. We're all bad guys. Mm. We all participate in this same fallen human nature. Yes, there are levels of, you know, culpability, I guess, but it's life is way more complex than that. So humility is, I think, really important. And I found this a goal worth working towards because when I do my best to apply humility, what it means is that I have to face the fact that I probably don't have a definitive right to an opinion on, like, you know, I don't know enough, honestly. And actually, even in areas that I feel like I'm fairly well read in, I have to hold it open hand. In fact, I mean, part of what happens when you exercise patience, to use another biblical virtue, and you patiently research an area, which is different to watching short form videos. Again, I'm not saying that we should go off into every issue and because you have to ask yourself, why am I researching this issue, right? But even in areas where I have been interested in and I've researched, the more that I do actually read and read on both sides and think critically, the more I realize how complex these issues actually are, the more it prevents me from making a definitive opinion. Let me use a theological example to stay away from hot button issues. You know, eschatology. So I shouldn't have. this probably is a hot button issue. But
good.
You know, I've just been looking at Revelation and in the Thrive Deeper podcast, and so you know, I went over some of the different views, you know, eschatological views, and like I'm reading between these views, and I'm thinking, well, there are just some things that are fundamentally not clear in this book.
Yeah.
But here are the things that are clear, right? And what I found is that the best of the biblical scholars tended to have a humility. Look, this is, you know, this is, I very strongly believe that this is what this is saying. Here are the reasons. But there's a kind of humility about that. There's conviction, but there's also a humility.
But we can't know for sure.
Where the problem is where you get, you know, like compare that, because I came across short form stuff. It was interesting because when I was
you were researching.
As I was reading this stuff started coming up, right? Are these videos on people expressing sort of eschatological views and very black and white. Mm. You know, if anyone disagrees with this, they're a heretic, right? And lots of caricaturing. Mm-hmm. It's the same old stuff, right? Caricaturing, big epitaph. Oh, they're a liberal. Mm-hmm. If they believe this, they're a liberal. It's like, no, what? No. Mm-hmm. If they had more courage, they would affirm this, you know, so they'll start using ad hominem arguments as well, is when you have appeal to the person, right? They just believe that because they're weak. You know, they're not courageous enough. Yeah. They're giving way to the world. Mm-hmm. So that's an ad hominem argument. And so, you know, and so what happens? I have had people angrily, so do you believe this view of the, and almost like if I even say, well, I have considered, that's almost not enough. Like, that's it. I'm leaving.
Yeah.
It's that level of, that level of response. Now that's an extreme, I admit, but that's someone that's basically been drawn into an algorithm that's watched this stuff that is very black and white, that polarizes people and makes them believe I've got the definitive answer.
But it's this recycling.
And I can judge those.
It's this recycling of it within you that amplifies it within you.
Yeah.
So it starts off small. You may not have had much opinion on it to start with, but the more you consume it, it fans that flame into a raging fire. Educate yourself. Get as many facts as you can.
This is where I'd say,
but you can't switch off. We're not advocating.
No.
Just disengage from.
Yeah, put out.
And
no,
have
we're not.
No
yeah.
opinion on anything.
I'm just trying to be measured about. Like, I want to encourage Christians. There's only so much time that we have, Connell. So what I'm saying is, how about we go deeply into what we know is the central and truthful things that are actually going to edify us and lead us to be the people that we're meant to be. I just think we need to measure how much we go down these rabbit holes.
I think there's more issues out there than we can possibly hold in our head. And I think some people are going to be more interested or motivated by certain views or causes and there's nothing even wrong with necessarily becoming angry, I don't think. Like, you can be angry. There's a lot of things in the world that, you know, that you shouldn't be comfortable with it. It should make you angry that, you know, levels of injustices or whatever. Mm. So you don't want to become numb, that you don't feel anything. And it's okay to be angry about certain causes, but you can only be focused on those things that you can actually do something about. Or you recognize that there are things that I'm into that other people aren't into, but we can't be into everything.
Yeah, I get that. So to use your example, there are some things that we, because I just want to dig into that too, because anger, of course, is a natural response. It's not always wrong that we get angry about things. The problem, again, I just think we need to be self-suspicious enough to know that our anger is, without a lot of self-awareness, anger is going to go in a wrong direction. You know, so you get angry about that issue because it's harm is being done and injustice is being done. The problem is when we make assumptions about how that is happening, why it's happening, and, you know, we essentially, again, take a sort of absolute position of judge. You can find a situation horrible and lamentable and cruel but still recognize that there are a whole complex tangle of reasons that led to that, that maybe you in the same situation would be just as bad. So I think that's got to measure, you know, the fact that this is a big thing in reflection because my background on my father's side is German, right? And one of the things that I've realized is that the next generation, and very much my generation, are very condemning of the previous generation, right? This is the anger thing. Mm-hmm. Now they would justify that, say these terrible things happen, you know, this generation did terrible, terrible things, and we should be angry about that. Yes, but the problem is we're assuming that if we were in their circumstance, we would not have done that. Mm. That's where the problem. Yeah. Now, we have the benefit of knowing more, but we share the same elements of human nature that are just going to come out in different ways in our generation. Mm. We're probably complicit in things that we're not yet recognizing, you know, because we're too busy judging
everyone else,
judging, you know, other people. And so we're not actually recognizing. And I think this comes back to the humility thing. By me recognizing, by not distancing myself off from the group of people or person that I'm being told about these terrible things that they did, I can't set myself off from those people because I participate in that. And actually, given the same circumstance, the same level of it, the same, you know, that it would be arrogant to assume that I would not have done the same thing.
So then it's not just about getting angry. So, because it becomes opinionated. And if the only place you end up is having opinion on something, for what purpose is it to have an opinion? So it's like the opinion is the goal here of having my opinion.
To be right.
Yeah. Basically. But there's only a certain number of things that you can do. Now, I like to kind of educate myself on a lot of things. And I think I'm pretty good at recognizing within myself that just about every view I hold is inherently biased. And I'm always looking at things and going.
And partial.
Yeah. Hmm. And the more that I learn about it, the more that there is that I didn't know about it. And so I do recognize within myself that there's a reason, like other people are strongly against the position that I've taken on this. And therefore, there's got to be something that I'm missing. And so I do tend to try to look at things from the other side. Now, what can I do about it? I can do absolutely nothing about that situation. But one of the things I do like to do is at least help people see that when they are angry, trying to teach people to at least see a bit of nuance in those issues. And I often find myself, depending on who I'm talking to, irrespective of my view, whether it's the pro position or the anti position, if I'm talking to people in the anti position, I try to kind of help them nuance their ideas a bit to see the pro position, or if I'm on the pro position, help them sort of nuance to see that the anti position, that there's a reason why they think that. Maybe that's the bit that I try to put back into solving the problem, isn't solving the problem, but trying to help people lower the temperature a bit in terms of how we're reacting from one side to the other, to do the bit more of that critical thinking to show, look, every issue, I can't think of any issue that isn't overloaded with complexity and more facts than I can possibly even reconcile. So I have to choose what facts I'm going to go
with. Which means that we need to suspend having a strong position or a strong opinion. One of the problems is we don't like that, because sitting in the discomfort of relative ignorance is difficult for us. Mm. And so we make ourselves believe that, no, this is the way it is, and therefore this is my position, this is my opinion.
But maybe a strong opinion, even then, I still think you can have a strong opinion, but you've got to balance it, put some guardrails.
But why do you have to have a strong opinion?
Because then you can end up saying, well, there isn't a right in a wrong, and we still fall back into
we believe that there's a right and a wrong, but the judgment about who is in the right and who is in the wrong, we're all in the wrong in some way, and the complexity, this is my point is that the situation with the human predicament is such that it's so complex, every circumstance is so complex, that there just is not, and in many cases, so complex that it's actually insoluble, like fundamentally insoluble.
Okay. Well, imagine having, say, Nazi Germany, living in that time, and not having an opinion about what's happening there.
Yep, good,
So there are things where there are legitimate things to be concerned about, and not to say, look, I'm not going to pursue having an opinion, but I just think there's a guardrails around it that practically every opinion you have, you've got to have some humility to know that you're still missing facts.
Even in that, you can have a strong sense that this is wrong, okay? So let's agree on that. I'm not saying you can certainly sense in this environment this is wrong. The question, what you do about it?
Yeah.
How you? And this was an interesting debate, actually, in Nazi Germany between theologians, like for example, between Karl Barth and Dietrich Bonhoeffer, and various others around should we try to assassinate Hitler?
Yeah.
Right. This was the big debate, and some said no, this is justified. Others said no, that's not going to make it any better. Now, it turned out that there were four different attempts to assassinate Hitler. All of them failed almost miraculously. Hitler himself believed that he was being almost divinely preserved, right? But it actually turned out that Hitler was the weak link. You know what I mean? If Hitler would have, it could have continued longer if Hitler had, you know, because it is essentially evil imploded on itself. So that's an example of where what people thought was the solution probably could have made, it just wasn't as simple as that. It's one thing to say that this is just kind of wrong, but it's another thing to know how to solve the problem. This is where, you know, I've often said throughout this episode, like, it's one thing to diagnose the problem. Like Karl Marx's Das Kapital, the capital, right? He diagnoses the problems with capitalism. Like, fair enough. But is communism his solution is like worse, way worse than what he's You know, there's so many philosophers through history and political theoreticians have recognized the problem. But that's it. That's the easy bit, right? It's when you propose a solution.
Keen to keep this moving because we are running a little out of time. I just do want to point listeners back. We did do an episode of Thrive Perspectives in December 2023 called Unity in a Culture of Opinion, where we talked a lot about forming these strong opinions. So I really would direct you back to that. I do want to just comment on a couple of things you guys have said over the last 2 or 3 hours. is I think the question of why do you need to have a strong opinion is an important one. Because I think, and I'm making this, dare I say, in this episode, perhaps a little bit black and white, but I think we can be so consumed with trying to form opinions on a whole lot of issues around the world, strong opinions, so doing lots of research, let's say, on a whole lot of issues around the world that, as you said, Connell, we can really do nothing about, and at the same time have no time to help at the local community centre or to, you know, help out at the whatever volunteering work you may be choosing to do where we can actually do something about helping. I think we can get so consumed about trying to form an opinion about things out there, not saying we shouldn't necessarily have our own opinion, but it can drive us to the point we have no time to do anything else.
Or you've ruined all your relationships because you're immersed in this stuff that you just can't work with anyone.
And just to bring, I think to bring back the thing about the nuance, we talked right at the start that every issue, Connell, I think you said it, in the world is really nuanced. And I think the thing to recognize about that, what makes pretty much every issue nuanced, is the fact that there are people involved, people who are created in the image of God, whom God loves. You know, if we think about perhaps the greatest crime, here's Jesus hanging on a cross, the people who crucified him, and what does he say? He says, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing, you know? And I think, again, I know I'm making it a bit black and white, but I think it's important to understand that this is about people. I just want to couple of scriptures, Matt, and then maybe we wrap this up. One of the ones that as I was kind of doing a little bit of thinking about this is about for us as individuals to guard our hearts. And I Proverbs 4:23, above all else, guard your heart, for everything you do flows from it. So essentially when we form these positions and opinions, it can actually then, as you said just a moment ago, affect our relationships with other people who perhaps have a different opinion to us. So discernment becomes a really important part of that. And I think asking ourselves the question, does this, whatever this is this drawing me closer to Christ or deeper into division? Is it actually pushing me? Is it creating greater division between me and others? The other scripture I wanted to point to is James 1:19-20. Everyone should be quick to listen, slow to speak, and slow to become angry, because human anger does not produce the righteousness that God desires.
And I think the Bible's full of it. Like, I mean, I've once, like, and I've spoken about guardrails as well. Like I've said in Ephesians, it says, be angry and do not sin. Do not let the sun go down on your anger. So there's like this thing of being consumed by anger and letting it burn. And it's like, it's okay to be angry, but don't let this consume you. Resolve it. Don't let it get carried through into the next day. So there's like those sort of guardrails, or we look
which at, again takes humility.
Yeah.
Or you look at the fruit of the spirit, or you look at in Proverbs 14, it says, whoever is slow to anger has great understanding, but he who has a hasty temper exalts folly. That ties so much into, I think, how we approach this whole.
So one practical step for me that I want to throw in there before you close it up, Matt, is I think one of the practical steps that I've experienced on the other end of it, being involved in a number of different Christian ministries and seeing Christians sharing things, is I think pause before you share something. You see something that you think you've got a really strong opinion, and so you decide to share it with all your friends and stuff. I think pause and, as you said, have that position of humility and go, maybe that's not actually helping, is just feeding the algorithm.
What's my motivation to do that?
Yeah, what is my motivation to do that? Totally.
Yeah. Just to reiterate, I think that humility is a good starting place, choosing humility. Not assuming that I know what's going on, recognizing that there's a complexity to the world and things that happen. Not only do I not know everything about that, but I'm very unlikely to know what the solutions are, if there are any. And in many cases, there are no solutions except for those put forward ultimately in Scripture, which is the redemption of the earth. And then there's the humility that says, I can't set myself off from the people that I feel angry about. To me, these work, like recognizing, you know, this is really complex. It does actually temper my anger to recognize that complexity, but then also to recognize, you know what, I'm not so different from these people. But finally, I want to commend what I'm going to call the joy of living uncomfortably in the world. This is actually the biblical virtue of hope. Hope is a willingness to not like the way that the world is, and to therefore be wrested away from a love of worldly solutions to it. And this is a big one, because I think we get drawn into worldly solutions, right? They're good band-aids, but they're just band-aids, right, for the human condition. It's not that they're not important, but they're only relatively important, you know, compared to what God is doing and will do to restore all things to the way they're meant to be. Hope is me investing myself and my passions and my anticipation in what God is bringing about. That hope is fed by a sense of discomfort with the way that things are, an ultimate dissatisfaction with any worldly solution, even if it's a good medium-term solution, right? But an ultimate, I can't, even with this solution, I'm not going to be comfortable, because we should not be comfortable in the world nor in our own skin. Hope is the ability to live in the tension. An illustration I would use is the more our hearts are warmed by the presence of God, the more we feel the cold of this world. You know, Paul says, we who have the first fruits of the Spirit groan inwardly. Why? Because as your heart is warmed by this deposit of things to come, as he refers to it, the Spirit is a deposit guaranteeing what is to come, he says in a number of places in his letters. You know, Paul is saying that this leads to this kind of groaning, because as we anticipate what's to come, we become less and less connected and content with what is right now. And so the joy of living uncomfortably in the world. Why the joy? Because the more you are wrested away from a love of this world, the more connected you will be to what God is doing and will do. And that is the foundation of our hope, which is the source of our joy.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of Thrive Perspectives. Our hope is that these discussions will challenge you to look at life from a new perspective. You'll find all our resources at the Thrive Today website, thrivetoday.tv. If there's a topic that you'd like us to discuss, please email us. Our email is contact@thrivetoday.tv. Until next time, our prayer is that you will thrive.